This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. When we talk about our current economic crisis, we often focus on unemployment, and with good reason. The jobless rate is at its highest level in decades. But unemployment is only part of our dismal economic picture. Just as many people are underemployed, unable to put together enough work to make ends meet. And then there are those people who do have full-time jobs that don't provide adequate wages and benefits to keep them above the poverty line. Earlier this month, the North Carolina Budget and Tax Center put out its first of what it hopes will be an annual State of Working in North Carolina report. It's going to try to capture the full picture of labor market conditions and worker well-being in the Tar Heel State. And right now, it's not a pretty one. In the studio with me is Alexandra Sirota. She is director of the North Carolina Budget and Tax Center and author of the report. Welcome back, Alexandra. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Also want to hear your story. If you are unemployed, underemployed, just getting by, give us a call, 877-962-9862. How do you assess your well-being as a worker in this current economy? And are you hopeful that things are going to get better? 877-962-9862, SOTAWNC.org. Alexandra, could you give us in broad terms what your report finds?
Sure. Basically, we know that the official end of the Great Recession was marked in June 2009. But since then, more than 24 months later, workers are still struggling. And that's mainly because of the failure to improve the jobs picture in the state. The result is hundreds of thousands of North Carolinians are struggling with unemployment, underemployment, as you mentioned. And combined with the greater impact of the Great Recession, this has brought a significant amount of economic hardship for North Carolina workers. The broader economic transformation that the state has been going through over the course of several decades has really led to declining wages, growing income inequality, all of which means that North Carolina's workers are struggling. As North Carolina's workers struggle, we know that the economy's pathway out of this downturn is going to be much more difficult.
So let's break some of this down. When we're talking about people who are underemployed, what do we mean?
We mean people who are both unemployed, who have taken part-time jobs for economic reasons, usually because they can't find a full-time job, and then folks who are marginally attached to the labor force. Combined, that's about one-fifth of North Carolina's labor force right now.
A diminished labor force. So one-fifth of a labor force that is down by 10%, right? Mm-hmm. And that's only those who are still looking for work. So that doesn't include even the discouraged workers. One-fifth of those are underemployed. And how do you measure that? What do you mean by how do I feel that if I'm underemployed? What's my life like?
Well, I mean, obviously, if you're working in a part-time job, but you really need a full-time job to make ends meet for your family, you're clearly having challenges meeting day-to-day basic needs, meeting your monthly payments on everything from the car that gets you to work to the cell phone that helps you communicate with your employer or your child's school. There are a number of ways in which the lack of a good-paying job or a job at all impacts the family and children and the broader community.
But what's going on here? Because, as you said, the recession is officially over. Corporate profits are way up. Wall Street's booming. It's so what we were expecting was once the businesses are back, the jobs will follow. They haven't. Is this just a lag time? We're just a little bit behind. Things will kind of turn around, catch up.
I mean, I think we all hope that things will catch up, but it won't just catch up without intentional efforts of policymakers and all of us to really focus on job creation. The story of the recovery and the failure of this recovery has been that we have not created the jobs that North Carolinians need. We face a jobs deficit of nearly 500,000. That's both the number of jobs that we need to make up for what we've lost and to keep pace with the fact that our workforce is still growing in North Carolina and folks are aging into the workforce without work opportunities, and that obviously impacts our economy.
Well, they're aging in and they're graduating in. So
sure.
College graduates now with huge bills to pay in terms of what they've taken out in loans are now facing that employment picture, which, as we said, should have turned around because the businesses are doing better. I think this underscores perhaps something that you found in your report, which is that the unemployment picture, worse now than it has been in decades, is something that's been going. It's a trend that preceded the downturn itself.
certainly North Carolina's economic transformation over a longer period has meant that workers have been struggling for far more than the past 3 to 4 years. The fact that we've lost manufacturing, that we've seen a tremendous growth in low-wage occupations, and at the other end of growth in high-skill occupations has meant that many North Carolina's workers and many North Carolina communities have struggled with very high unemployment rate and very high rates of economic hardship. In order to address that and to think about that in the context of the acceleration that's happened in the Great Recession, really digging into the specifics and policy solutions that can target those communities and those individuals is critical.
And it's important to really highlight this disconnect, because it does go back, and it even reaches back into the 90s in a way, that the boom that business felt that we could see reflected on Wall Street through the 90s. Again, we had a recession in 2001. Business recovers through that entire period when we used to see the fate of workers and the the profit of corporations linked. They had become decoupled, and we didn't have a great recession to talk about, so it wasn't part of our story. That has been happening now for a good 15 years, the separation between working people and corporate profit.
Right, absolutely. And the growth in productivity even over the 30-year period and the disconnect with median wages is something that we know at the national level is occurring, and it's driving a lot of the income inequality we see and a lot of the economic hardship. The real critical thing, if we understand that that is what is happening, is to come up with solutions that support workers. And I think the piece of the discussion that's been missing is we've been focused on businesses and their role in job creation, but we've not been focusing on workers and what they contribute to the economy and how critical that will be for our future.
So what would those policies look like that would improve that picture?
Well, we talk a lot about the role of policymakers can play in creating good quality jobs, to ensuring that as jobs are being created in North Carolina specifically and taxpayer dollars are being used to attract businesses, that those are dollars that are being invested in companies paying a living wage, providing benefits to their workers. We think it's critical that workers in low-wage jobs receive support for employment. There are many challenges that folks with low-wage jobs face in terms of balancing their family and work responsibilities, and the additional support to make that employment possible is critical.
It makes perfect sense to say only invest in those companies that are going to do what's best for your workers from that point of view. The problem is, once the inequality sets in, here's what you're going to hear. We're going to hear all about the value and virtue of the market. And they're going to say, if we put those kinds of impositions on those businesses, they will go elsewhere. So competition, the market, let the market decide, even though the market has not provided the jobs. How do you fight? And the worse it gets, of course, the more competitive it gets. The more people who are unemployed, cheaper that labor becomes, the better it is for corporations. They don't really want to see unemployment go down too much, not if you're a shareholder.
Right. Well, I mean, I think the real point here is that when we look at the projection for North Carolina, we are starting to see North Carolina become a low-wage state. I mean, we've been a low-wage state. The continued growth of low-wage occupations means that we're driving towards a point where our economy is not going to work for the vast majority of North Carolinians. And when that happens, we know that economies are more susceptible to business cycles, that they'll face ongoing challenges in being competitive and attracting businesses without a trained workforce. We know that that's critical. So without addressing the issues of workers' well-being and the state of the workforce in North Carolina, we can't expect to build a stronger economy in the state.
On the state of things today, we are talking about the state of unemployment. One of the things, Alexandra, we tried to do is a number of people have contacted you in the course of putting your report together and over several months. We tried to get in touch with some of those people, and interestingly enough, people who had once had phones who could contact you no longer do. We had a hard time. We went through a very long list of people who have, between the time they contacted you and we tried to get in touch, have lost their phones. People are falling into poverty before our very eyes.
That's right. I think not only falling into poverty, but we're seeing the beginnings of some lifelong impacts for many North Carolinians. One story of a worker that was shared with us was he and his wife had been unemployed for such a long time, they'd found it hard to meet the needs of their young children and had to send them off to live with their grandparents because they just didn't feel like they could support them any longer. So those types of decisions are happening on a daily basis, and there will have long-term effects not only on those parents but their children as well.
And it breaks up the very social networks that you could rely on in hard times to hold things together. Now you break those up even further. On the state of things today, we want to hear from you, 877-962-9862, sot@wunc.org. Talking about the labor market, the well-being of workers, we're talking with Alexandra Sirota, who is the director of the North Carolina Budget and Tax Center, author of a report called The State of Working in North Carolina. Looking forward to your phone calls at 877-962-9862. On the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking about the state of working in North Carolina, the title of a new report from the North Carolina Budget and Tax Center. I'm joined in the studio by Director Alexandra Sirota. I want to bring Gene Nickel into the conversation now. He is Boyd Tinsley Distinguished Professor of Law and Director of the Center on Poverty, Work, and Opportunity at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Gene, welcome. Good to have you back.
Nice to be here, Frank.
Taking your phone calls as well, 877-962-9862, sot@wunc.org, to share with us a story talking about unemployment, underemployment, and the state of working in North Carolina. Gene, just before the break, we were talking about, you know, Alexandra talking about at least one, you know, potential policy change that could take place, encouraging businesses through tax strategies to hire people and make them sustainable jobs. And I pointed out that they can go somewhere else, that the marketplace itself is militating against us. Are we at a point now where the market is actually working, when we talk about market forces, are actually working against employment?
Well, we're at least at a place where we have what looks to be structural challenges, which, as I know you both said a minute ago, even predate the census. I work at the university, and one sort of small component of this that I see every day now is young people graduating, facing much different career paths potentially than when I graduated from college or graduated from law school. We're entering into a circumstance where we seem to be accepting or embracing the notion that maybe 10%, 11%, or as you said, a real unemployment rate of much higher is the norm. If that happens, the destructive impact on that on our community is massive and long-lasting. So we have that worrisome structural component. There's also, if you look at, and I know you guys were suggesting this as well, if you look at the development of our economy in the last three decades, one of the most remarkable statistics that I sort of dwell on is if we could find out there amongst North Carolina workers or national workers the median wage, that person right in the middle, let's call him a male, and sort of if we could find the guy who's the median worker in the United States and in North Carolina, and we could go back 30 years, in real terms, that guy is making less money than his father did, if we put this in sexist terms. In the meantime, in that 30 years ago, the top 1% was capturing about 8% of our total national income. Pretty good. Now, last year, that top 1% probably captured 25% of our income. So one structural difficulty we're facing is that average workers have actually fallen back compared to 30 years ago. In that intervening three decades, the folks at the top are capturing maybe three times on a percentage basis of the part of the pie that they were. That suggests that we have large challenges which threaten the dignity of Americans, which threaten equality, but also, you know, one of the things I think we're seeing, they threaten our ability to have a consumer-based recovery because working folks are not necessarily making enough money to drive that engine.
Well, and that may have been one of the things during the Great Depression that caused even the business community to get behind some kind of government intervention. Hey, if these people stay unemployed, they can't buy our stuff. Now we don't need Americans to buy our stuff anymore. We have millions of people in India and China. I have read reports that say the business sector is no longer concerned about supporting a middle class in America. They can get other buyers.
Yeah. And I've read those too, and certainly there's some truth to it, maybe even a dominating truth. But, you know, that can't be an acceptable outcome for our policymakers, for American government, for our society as a whole. We have to have, it seems to me, a much more compelling and I think a sort of laser-like focus on what's happening economically to the bottom half in the United States. They fall out of our politics, oddly, for reasons of money in politics and sort of complications of the American political process. But in truth, we likely need a politics now which would focus on the bottom 55%.
Well, I want to talk more about that. I want to go to the phones right now, but I do want to come back to that question, the political question of why the bottom 55, why the bottom 75% aren't voting the way that it would seem to be in their interest given the thrust of this conversation. But first, I want to hear from Allie, who has joined us on the line from Chapel Hill. Hello, Allie.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Did you have a comment for us?
Yeah, I moved here from Brooklyn in June. I actually moved here in hopes that cost of living being not as great as it is in Brooklyn. And, you know, with my skill set and experience, I graduated in 2010 and really haven't been able to find a job since then. And I feel like, you know, college students are really underrepresented these days. You know, every friend I have who I graduated with is unemployed.
And you got some bills to pay, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I've got plenty of bills to pay. I'm actually on welfare and 7 months pregnant. So, you know, it's just, it's been really hard. And, you know, a lot of my friends are in the same position.
Thanks for the call, Ellie. Let's get a response. Alexandra, you probably heard stories like this in putting your report together.
Certainly, and we know that the statistics bear this out in North Carolina, that the youngest age group, 18 to 24, as well as the oldest age group, 55 plus, are experiencing the highest levels of unemployment, double digit. I think obviously the approaches are very different for both groups, but it's clear that this this phenomena of high unemployment is impacting all North Carolinians. I want to go back to one of the big things that I think, besides just the phenomena of unemployment, is the lack of jobs. And, you know, she mentioned there's just not that many jobs out there. And we know that for every one unemployed worker, or I'm sorry, for every four unemployed workers, there's only one job out there. And that's not that there are four workers applying for those that one job. There is just one job there. We know that's true in the South. We know that if we don't address the number of jobs that are out there in the marketplace, in the economy, that workers aren't going to be able to earn a living that will sustain families, that will allow for potential career mobility in the long term. And so going back, I think, to the focus on jobs is really going to be critical.
When we think about that, you know, we had a guest on this show earlier this week. Doug Rader just sent a report to the governor. One of the items in that report was that wind power could supply 130% of our energy needs over the next 20 years or so. Wind power. So somebody's got to make those windmills. So you don't have to have the North Carolina State production company who makes windmills. You can actually pay companies to do it and hire people to do that. What would be the obstacle? And it seems to me that there is an obstacle, a kind of political obstacle, to actually going to sustainable energy that would create jobs. Because the answer to your question, the first answer is, well, the jobs went overseas. They're not here. Mm-hmm. But they are here. Mm-hmm. It's just that somebody has to have the will, don't they, to actually spend money. And that would be, I would guess, public money.
Right.
Because the market hasn't flipped yet. Because to wait for the market to respond means gas has to get to, what, $7, $8? We all have to feel real pain for the market. or we could plan now. Gene, what's in the way? Why not?
I mean, you identify particular obstacles that may be in the way. At least by implication, I think you do, Frank, when you're talking about wind power and other sorts of green jobs, which sometimes can then compete with a status quo of employment, which economic authority, which is troubling. But I think it's as Alexandra put it. That is, if we realize that we have first and foremost a job crisis, a literal emergency. This young woman who's just come to Chapel Hill, let me offer you welcome to Chapel Hill and say that my two oldest daughters have just gone to New York, so there's something of an exchange going here. But I think the indication which flows from this is something of what begins to happen or frankly continues to happen and expands when we have large numbers of us unemployed, that we think first of the impact on them and of their families. But of course, it also has an impact on the rest of the labor market, the competition for the remaining jobs. More and more jobs become low wage. More and more jobs don't have accompanying benefits. So the plight of, as Alexandra and her good colleagues at the Justice Center put it, the plight of working North Carolinians suffers quite directly and dramatically from this very high level of unemployment. That would mean, I would think, that our policymakers and the business community and the like would see us as facing stark emergency on the front of jobs. They would embrace not only the sorts of opportunities, Frank, that you're describing, but we obviously have construction needs, school construction needs, infrastructure needs, which were we to have major jobs programs to try and address, we know that that's not money thrown away, that's money invested in the future, and it would have the sanguine benefit of putting many more of us to work.
Let's go back to the phones now. Ellen is on the line from Burlington. Hello, Ellen.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Do you have an observation for us?
Yes, I do. In the 60s and 70s, you had high schools with hands-on programs to give students real-world experience. You could be close to an electrician's job. You could be kind of an apprentice. And high schools have given up so many of their hands-on programs to the community college, and hardly a mutter has been said. But now you have marginal students who are dropping out of high school and basically are unqualified to go on to community college, and there's nothing to fill that gap with hands-on programs. I'll take my answer offline.
Thanks, Ellen. Alexandra?
Right. I mean, I think that's a really important point, that the way in which we make diverse opportunities available to students so that there are pathways to the labor market that fit with the interests and needs of the industries is really critical. North Carolina has done a really good job at the community college level of training both the current existing workforce, retraining those who have lost their jobs for emerging industries. That all costs money, and that requires policymakers to make an investment in those structures and those programs. We know that increasingly the system leadership at both DPI and the community colleges and UNC are looking at the pathways and strengthening the connections between their curriculum. But those types of innovations and those types of connections to industries that are emerging technology requires investment. It requires students to have time in a lab, to have time working with advanced technologies and getting that exposure. And those are dollars that are well spent, and they will, in the long run, create a workforce that's competitive with globally. And that's the kind of thing we need to be thinking about, I think.
Frank, I can just add, because this is an issue that Alexandra and I have worked together on, the role of community colleges becomes all the more paramount in these tough economic times. It is not helpful to us to slash the budget of the community college system when the demand for the skills which can come through that tier of instruction is so pronounced. Also, the legislature has at least in some particulars, made it more difficult or refused to make it easier for folks going to community college to get federal financial aid, the sort of cheapest route to financial aid. That's a seems to me a large mistake. So in these tough times, we need to be investing in education, but we particularly need to be investing, it seems to me, in the community college system, which can be so helpful on the actual employment front.
Yeah, but let me get back to one of your assumptions and again challenge this, that somehow we all suffer and it's not even good for the business environment if this unemployment continues for long. If businesses can continue to make big profits while unemployment is 10%, and in fact, because it's 10%, because they point blank tell their employees, you got a complaint? You're lucky you have a job. There's not a lot of organizing going on these days for better conditions, for the kind of things that would improve people's lifestyle. If they can get by, if they can even prosper in these times, what interest would they have in seeing their taxes raised to improve an education system that would reduce unemployment? I have to ask that point blank.
Yeah.
I mean, I would just say that I don't know that we can expect this path to be sustainable much longer. I mean, we are already seeing some real concern in the markets around what's going on in the jobs front. And that's Wall Street speaking back to Main Street, back to. So I think that it's really important not to give too much credence to this model of business being able to sustain this in the long term. I think the real strength in an economy is built out of full participation, and we are far from that point right now. And businesses recognize time and time again in survey after survey that what really allows them to grow, expand, and innovate is demand for their goods and services. And that needs to come at least in part from here in the States and here in North Carolina.
Well, and the frank truth of it is that, you know, looking at it politically, if Wall Street, if major economic powers are not going to have loyalty to the communities that support them, to the United States, to the workers who make up the citizenry in this nation, then at the very least, we need to push back on the array of public policies that we have, which favor the wealthiest, favor the Wall Street sector. We've just bailed them out. You would think that would lead to at least a modest affection for the people of the United States. But we began this by talking about needing a politics which more directly and potently focuses on the bottom, whatever you want to call it, 55% or 60%. Percent. It seems to me we need to be sure in our public policies that that's our focus. And if the if Wall Street's not going to pay attention to that, then we need to make sure we are, and that we stop having and developing policies which favor those who are not going to contribute to the Commonwealth in the long run.
Let's talk about that 55%. Why isn't there more agitation? We talked about the perhaps why there isn't a kind of market response to this. Why isn't there a political response to this? A lot of people unemployed have been for a long time. Historically, we've seen there's been political price to pay. There appears not to be now. What's going on?
Well, this is one of the great mysteries of American politics. I'm hoping it's one that we get past. But we are particularly familiar with this in the South. We are the poorest part of the United States. We have the most poor people compared to any other region of the country. We also tend to have, broadly speaking, the highest number of politicians who are untroubled by it. So there's this disconnect between economic injustice, which sweeps across race, which sweeps across region, and demands and ought to demand a politics that alters our focus very significantly. Right now, we have a politics, in part because of the influence of money, in part because of the sort of division which comes through the chopping and cutting of the electoral pool, I guess, that we have a politics which leaves those at the bottom out. If you look at the bottom 30%, they don't register in the political calculus of the great bulk of our leaders. And they're going only to register, I think, in powerful terms when through a great deal of organization, they demand the attention that is implicit in democracy.
Alexandra?
Yeah, I would just add that I think a big part of this story is the loss of some of the key institutions that grew the middle class in North Carolina, and well, maybe not so much in North Carolina, but across the country. And that would be unions, for one, a voice to represent workers in their workplace, clearly has a significant role in ensuring the well-being of workers. The fact that policymakers have not invested over the past 30 years continued to invest in those structures that were built post-war to build a middle class has meant a lack of strength in that community to really connect with and understand the really critical role that public investments have had in their day-to-day life. If you talk to my father's generation, he knows that the GI Bill got him into education.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to talk about why those things have changed over these past 50, 60 years when our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, 877-962-9862. If you want to join the conversation, stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking this hour about the current economic situation in North Carolina and beyond. Unemployment, underemployment, the growing market of low-wage jobs, people who can't support themselves even though they're working. Jean Nickel is with me in the studio, director of the Center on Poverty, Work, and Opportunity at UNC. Also with us is Alexandra Sirota, who is the head of the North Carolina Budget and Tax Center and author of a report, The State of Working North Carolina. And joining us now by phone from New York is historian Steve Fraser. Steve is editor-at-large of the journal New Labor Forum. He's author, most recently, of Wall Street, America's Dream Palace. Welcome to the show, Steve. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Taking phone calls, too, 877-962-9862, talking about unemployment, underemployment. If you've had experience with this, give us a call at 877-962-9862. Steve, you've heard the first two-thirds of this program, and I think the takeaway is that we're doing very, very poorly by workers here in America. It doesn't seem to have an effect politically or in on Wall Street. And the fact is that that was not always true. There was a price to pay in, through much of the 20th century. Take us back to the time.
Yeah, it was a big price to pay even further back than that, well into the 19th century. You know, our ancestors found the phenomenon of unemployment appalling and shocking. They had never experienced anything like that before as the business system took hold in 19th century America and reacted radically to this new phenomenon. In mid-19th century America, there were occupations of state houses. There were demands for public factories to be established to employ the unemployed, public farms. There were demands to establish a kind of cooperative network of factories that would sort of employ the unemployed. There were mass marches all over the country in late 19th century America during the Great Depression of the 1890s. The most famous is probably Coxey's Army. Jacob Coxey was a small businessman, actually, from Ohio, who led hundreds of people to Washington, D.C. in 1893, demanding public employment. But there were similar such armies of the unemployed, what might be called the Reserve Army, has been called the Reserve Army of the unemployed, all over the country. And this is the 19th century. And a lot of that protest movement about unemployment was tied to larger questions of having to do with the savagery of the capitalist system, laissez-faire capitalism in late 19th century America, raising demands, which some of which later became part of our institutional framework, demands for some form of public relief, unemployment insurance, public works. All of these issues and demands were raised by 19th century Americans and, of course, became much more prominent and finally effective during the New Deal era of the 30s, when, again, there were enormous protests against unemployment. It was clearly the most severe and devastating episode of unemployment in the country's history. There were unemployed leagues all over the country, which actually banded together with employed workers to demand work not only from the government, but from corporations. There were seizures of shuttered public utility lines and shuttered coal mines, seizures by unemployed workers who then put them back into operation under their own auspices. There's a long history here, both of mass resistance and protest and about unemployment, and finally, in mid-20th century America, a government response. Although there were government responses even earlier locally. There were public relief efforts made in various cities and states during the 19th century.
I was going to say, politicians couldn't afford to ignore that kind of mass protest even in the 19th century. But I want to take you back to something you said at the very beginning, which was that unemployment was considered a kind of insult. What is this thing called unemployment? It's an abomination. Where did that stem from?
Yeah, that's a critical question. Who were these people? Well, many of them were then not only employed in factories of various kinds, but still maintained or were entirely farmers, handicraftsmen, hunters, fishermen. Unemployment was unknown to them. There might be seasonal oscillations in how hard they worked, but they not only worked all the time, they had their own means of subsistence. They weren't dependent on employers or big farmers or landowners who had the means of production to employ them. They had their own. And even during the early 19th century, when you get the first cyclical crises and you begin to get unemployment, people could get by because they still had common grazing rights to common lands. They had fishing rights, hunting rights. They maintained vegetable gardens. They raised domestic animals. There were a variety of ways and means of support outside the dominant, what was becoming the dominant economic system. It's only when that vanishes and we become, and please pardon the expression, working class, not middle class, but working class, that is people without the means of self-support, where you're utterly dependent on those who do control those means of production, that people say, wait a second, what is happening here? How are we supposed to survive? And begin to turn their anger and resentment and a sense of astonishment at this new system of capitalism.
So Alexandra, I want to talk with you about the people you met and came in contact with putting the report together. Steve's talking about a time when folks were brush up against owning their own work. They had it, something to fall back on. Now we're generations away from that. Do people feel that same sense of outrage at unemployment? We have a very different view about employment. We take for granted that shareholders own our work, that the corporation owns all the work, and we just have to walk up, knock on their door, and hand them an application. That's how we get work.
Right. I mean, I think that's true to some extent. I think we've talked with a number of folks who are small business owners who are struggling in this environment, and they ostensibly own the means of their own production and the goods and services that they're creating for the marketplace, and are facing a lack of demand for that, and that's creating challenges for them. In terms of the workers themselves, I mean, I think we know that many workers have been outraged by the lack of jobs, the lack of concern about the lack of jobs, and the demonization of workers as if this would be their fault that they haven't been able to find a job. I mean, I think going back to the earlier point, the reality is there aren't jobs out there for a vast majority of workers who are looking for work. And so the outrage, I think, is there. I think the challenge in this new environment that we're in now, that's developed over the past 30 years, is that we've ignored the critical role that the public sector plays in monitoring and regulating and supporting workers and making sure that workers are fairly paid. That role has broadly been diminished and dismissed by many North Carolinians, many Americans, and I think increasingly workers that we talk to are very concerned that that's a critical role that needs to come back.
You know, Frank, we've moved actually too much towards the opposite mindset that Steve is talking about. That is, if at one time we thought that high levels of unemployment was just unacceptable, the idling of America, the sort of leaving fallow this workforce, and the denial of dignity and contribution which comes from that, now we've seemed to have accommodated ourselves as a larger community to the notion that we may have very large numbers of us unemployed, And as Alexandra was saying, we're seeing now an increased anger at the unemployed. This has come up in the debates over the continuation of unemployment insurance. People are impatient with what they see as insufficiently incentivized folks on the question of employment, which is, I think, almost literally the opposite of what Steve is talking
about. Yeah, I would emphatically agree with that. You know, we now talk about, we have for the last 50 years, talk about something called the natural rate of unemployment. The very concept would have stunned people 150 years that unemployment could ever be. They considered it unnatural, grotesque. We have become, it's normalized in our society. In fact, it's gotten worse than that. There are a whole branch of neoliberal economic thinking actually thinks that there may be levels of unemployment that are too low. In order to effectively have for the economy to effectively function, the world's been turned upside down.
But how is let me ask you how that's possible, because you talked about, you know, Coxey's army. We know there have been a number of movements where people just took control. They got fed up. Alexandra talking about the number of people she talks to, 2010, 2011, they're outraged. That does not translate into political action. What has changed, Steve?
Yeah, that's the big, that as I think Gene said earlier, because I did hear the tail end of the show before I got on, that's the big mysterious question. What has changed? So many things have changed. Alexandra, I think, mentioned a key thing, the withering away of the labor movement. After all, much of the protest and effective political mobilization around the issue of unemployment came from the organized trade union movement, either within their own ranks by establishing unemployment benefit funds or by demanding unemployment insurance and in a variety of ways. The near death of the labor movement in this country has enormously weakened the possibility of mounting this kind of resistance. Obviously, money, the domination of the political system by money has contributed heavily to that. The conversion of the Democratic Party to a kind of version of neoliberal republicanism, and this has been going on now for, I don't know, 10, 20 years, their own fealty to the banking establishment, which really took root under Clinton and Rubin in the 90s, has so weakened what used to be a kind of robust, populist, working class friendly wing of the Democratic Party that too doesn't exist any longer to mobilize people. And of course, one thing that needs to be said is that unemployment is a very demoralizing experience. It's not easy. There may have been a lot. There were a lot of protest movements in the past, but it isn't easy for people. It's an isolating experience. Mm-hmm. It's a demoralizing experience. It may produce outrage, but also a kind of weakening of the will, a sense of self-blame, as Alexandra mentioned, and so on. So it's no easy task. But a lot of the institutional framework that used to resist that is gone.
Well, I have to ask, though, that institutional framework grew out of that outrage and that sense of need, and it pushed the political process. And it insisted that at least one party pay attention to this,
right.
And so they couldn't become the banker's best friend on both sides of the aisle.
That's right.
So again, I guess the question remains,
yep.
You know, what does it take when you get people who literally say, let them die,
right,
and they support a particular party and felt very comfortable in that meeting saying, you know, cheering, let them die.
I don't know. It's part of the souring of a national mood that's happened now for a long time. We're in a very dangerous period of time when unemployed and other kinds of people become the ready, vulnerable scapegoats for problems that originate elsewhere. And the real danger, I think, is that we may be becoming a kind of society, an economy anyway, that's eating itself alive at its lower end, reproducing poverty and the kind of social decay which can produce very rancorous emotions in people. You can see it already, and that's part of the picture.
Alexandra, from your point of view, does this kind of discourse actually contribute to any kind of change, or are we, in a sense, talking over people's heads? If we talk about the structural injustice of a system, and I've been looking for work, I don't even have time to listen to this show.
Right. I mean, well, I think to some extent what we need to do is go back to those organizing efforts that have occurred in the past and learn from them. I think it needs to look a lot differently. And I think we need to understand that there are a lot of folks who will take the time to engage with their local elected officials, will engage with their policymakers to make the case for the situation that they're facing. And that kind of pressure we can bring to bear. But I think the conversation really needs to be bring back in those voices and make clear what is it that workers need to make ends meet, to continue to contribute and participate in the economy. And we don't always have that conversation because we remain focused on the bigger issues, perhaps, as well as what's going on for business.
And Jean Nickel, a lot of that discussion is aimed at changing a policy, and sometimes we feel despair. Workers may feel despair, as Steve was saying, a kind of you begin from a position of powerlessness. You're facing bankers and corporate interest. Could part of the answer lie not so much in what we say to get things changed, but in non-participation, in withdrawing participation from a system that many would agree is fundamentally unjust?
Well, I think, whether you're talking about various kinds of boycotts or moves, changes towards localism and the like, that's entirely possible, that's going to be one of the reactions. I think that, to me, the extent to which there's a hopeful side of this is Americans are a sort of proud and cantankerous, and they believe an immensely accomplished people on a potent mission. And I also think more and more of us are coming to believe that the structures in which they face right now are not fair in the way that that we grew up believing. So that just by working hard, complying with the rules, you're not necessarily going to get ahead. In fact, it may be quite the opposite. I think Americans won't in the long run accept that, and that they will become energized in ways that maybe our Wall Street bettors don't necessarily believe. We probably need a Huey Long or something these days, and I don't think we're very far from it.
Well, Steve Frazier, I've got about 30 seconds left. Is there a Huey Long? Is that sort of the answer?
Yeah, I think that he may touch on something very important. What I think inspired our ancestors who did rebel and resist was not only the particulars of unemployment, but a vision of a different kind of society. And we don't have that vision now. Everything's been so normalized, including unemployment, that we think that what our ancestors used to call the wages system is the inevitable way things must always be and always have been. But our ancestors knew differently, and their protests were enfolded within a more general anti-big business kind of culture and vision of a different kind of cooperative society. And I think that's maybe what we need to look for. Huey Long may be one instance of holding out a vision of something new to inspire people. And I think that's what may be missing now.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Steve Frazier, editor-at-large for the journal New Labor Forum, author most recently of Wall Street, America's Dream Palace. Also with us, Alexandra Sirota is director of the North Carolina Budget and Tax Center, author of the report, The State of Working North Carolina. You can find that report online, ncjustice.org. Jean Nickel is also with us. Jean is the Boyd Tinsley Distinguished Professor of Law and Director of the Center on Poverty, Work, and Opportunity at the University of North Carolina. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.